I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nowra show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I. Yeah,
we've both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Andrew Sharp played the Artful Dodger in J.C. Williamson's 1966 revival of the musical Oliver, opposite Tony LeMond and Richard Wordsworth. He was the replacement Brad Majors in the original Australian production of The Rocky Horror Show, playing the role of Dr. Frankenfurter in its final Sydney weeks. Andrew was a member of the original companies of seminal Australian plays like A Hard God by Peter Kinnear and Season at Sarsaparilla by Patrick White. He played opposite Alan Bates in Simon Gray's Starstruck in the West End Theatre District of London, and had a stint in Michael Blakemore's production of Death Trap. Andrew was one of the young doctors and led the cast in Undercover, a television series about the invention of the burly bra. He has also directed opera and presently runs a hotel in rural New South Wales. He is a man of many parts, a most accomplished actor, and a very entertaining raconteur, furnished with 1,000 stories garnered from a wonderful life in the theatre. Stage's featured guest in episode 473 is Andrew Sharp. That's always, where do you start?
Yeah, indeed.
You start with it.
You start with now.
With a conversation, with a hello.
Yeah,
you're turning your phone off?
Yeah, actually, I'll put it on. Oh, I recommended a very close friend that she see Anatomy of the Fall, and she's just thanked me for the recommendation. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
I saw Holding the Man last night, by the way.
Isn't it extraordinary?
Oh.
You had seen it 20 years ago? Yeah.
I'm still crying.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know, you would have known all those people, you knew Tim.
Well, I know Peter Kingston. Have you interviewed him?
No.
Oh, he's one you should... Have you thought of that?
Yes, he's on my list, so... Yeah.
I mean, he's forgotten now, but he did great work at the Stables. Mm. Really great work. I knew him, I saw him at NIDA, and quite quickly he discovered that he could direct, and he did superb work at the Stables, or whatever they called it in those days. It's had so many name changes. But he didn't direct Holding the Man. It was the original
David
production.
Berthold.
Was it David's production originally? Mm. But Peter is in the show. Peter is the director who is directing... What was
Soft Targets?
Soft Targets, yeah, exactly. He was the doyen of the Stables in those days. And I did know Tim, but only in passing. I mean, not really. But hello, Tim, hello, Andrew, dinner for you. You know, that was it. But... because he was at Swinburne. You don't know that I went to Swinburne, do
no,
you?
No.
No, I did the...
This is prior to NIDA.
I didn't go to NIDA. I turned NIDA down.
Really?
Ooh, that was naughty, wasn't it?
Why did you turn it down?
Do you want... Are we recording?
Yeah, we're recording. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we're recording?
Yeah, we're recording.
Now
you clam up.
That's right. You shouldn't have told me. You know you want to. Have some Madeira. Well, I'd wanted to be an actor since I was four. Mm. And it was all I ever dreamed about. And every single adult that I ever met, including notably Tony LeMond, said to me, don't do it, don't do it. It's a terrible profession. It's a terrible life. You'll hate it. You're not suited to it. Don't do it, you know. And of course, the more they said that, the more determined I was, because, you know, that really made it, you know, don't eat this apple. After I just auditioned for it, and in fact, Terry Clark, who had taught me at Cranbrook, coached me. And I did a speech of Goldberg from The Birthday Party, and a speech of Henry the, a Hotspur from Henry the Fourth, is it? Yeah. I got in, and I was 17, and I suddenly went, well, I feel very, very young and very naive. My father had said to me, do you really want to do this? Because he was worried about career, really, more than anything else, you know, and security. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm good enough to get into NIDA, then perhaps I am good enough to be a professional. So I'll follow the advice of every adult I've ever met, and I'll go to university where they do a drama course at New South Wales University. And, of course, I spent my entire time being in plays.
Rather than study.
Acting in Dramsock plays and doing no study at all.
What was the course you enrolled in?
Arts, of course, right. Okay. With drama, English, sociology, and Russian. And the reason I studied Russian was because in my last year at school, I saw the old Tote production of Three Sisters, which was my introduction to Chekhov, and it was the most beautiful, romantic thing. I mean, it was so sad. And I was, you know, a bit of a drama queen, and... It was a legendary production that was directed by Robert Quentin.
Who was in it?
June Collis, who was Robert Quentin's wife, played Natasha. James Condon played Vashinin. Quickly, you've taken me by surprise there. Look, it was at the Old Tote.
Yeah.
And it was in the original Old Tote Theatre, and anybody could find it online. It was spectacular. Especially for a schoolboy that didn't even know about Chekhov. I'd never seen anything more beautiful in my life. Yeah. So that's why I studied Russian at the university.
And it would come in handy when you got to play Chekhov yourself. Did you get to play Chekhov?
I have to rack my brains. In fact, I assisted Nick Enright at Suds, funnily enough. A couple of years later, when I was at university, Nick did a production of Three Sisters. And I was at New South Wales, but he was at Sydney University. We had a very strange connection as well, because Nick played Noah Claypool in the revival of Oliver, which would have been in about 1968, I'm guessing, because in 1966, Williamson's did Oliver at the Royal with Tony LeMond. That's how I met Tony. And Richard Wordsworth played Fagin. And when it was first on in 1960, we all went to see it. And I was like aching to be in it, aching. And of course, everyone said, oh, you're far too young. Well, I was only seven. I was furious when I found out that the youngest boy was in fact seven. And I could have been in it even in the 1960s. So I came home from school. I used to read the Sun every Friday. They would have the Sun newspaper would have a showbiz column every Friday. And I came home from school. I was 13. And I saw, great to see that Tony LeMond and Richard Wordsworth are heading the cast of J.C. Williamson's revival of Oliver. I went straight to the telephone and rang J.C. Williamson's and said, I want to audition. And they said, oh yeah, what's your name? And I said, whatever. What's your phone number? I said, whatever, and forgot all about it. One day I came home from school several months later, and my mother said, J.C. Williamson's had just telephoned. I'd forgotten to mention it to my parents. And and they want you to audition the day after tomorrow. So I remember in science class hiding the score. I was going to sing Consider Yourself at the audition, and I was trying to learn it in science class.
Because you're auditioning for the Dodger?
No, I was just... No, I thought I would be so just, lucky to be
just
anything.
To be a workhouse boy.
Anything. Or one of Fagin's anything. Boys, yeah. I mean, you know, I've spent my
I'd
life...
I'd do anything.
Indeed. And I spent my life just assuming that everybody else is, you know, smarter, cleverer, wiser, more talented than me, and as most of us do, in fact. And I just thought, well, I consider yourself, I vaguely knew the song, but I didn't really quite know the words. And as I said, I was trying to learn it in science class because the audition was that afternoon after school. Talk about cramming at the last minute. Lesson number one, never learn your lines on the day of the opening night. Anyway, so I went to, my mother took me, and there was a laneway outside the old Theatre Royal, which long since demolished, which was like a loading dock, in fact, and the stage door was there. The place was swarming with schoolboys, all in there. Mostly they come from St. Mary's, though. And it took quite a long time. Anyway, eventually I got to go on, and of course I completely forgot all the words. I'm standing on the stage of the Theatre Royal, belting Consider Yourself. But Peter, I had already, well, I was quite experienced because I'd been a choir boy in our local Anglican church since the age of 7. So I'd been rehearsing for this for 6 years, really. And I used to be a bit of a soloist. I used to sing songs like Oh, for the Wings of a Dove, which was a very sad anthem, of all about being persecuted. And then the singer sings of, you know, my enemies hate me and they're persecuting me and I just want to fly away like a dove. So, I mean, I was mentioning before we started recording how I had this propensity towards tragedy, and I particularly love Good Friday. I mean, it was so sad. But, anyway, so I knew a little bit about performing. And they called me back. So I went back the next day. And there were two of us. It was a short list of two. And we stood side by side. And the guy's name was Mike Williams, who later went on to be the floor manager of the Mike Walsh Show. Right. And we alternated, because in those days...
His name was Sherl.
Sherl, that's right. Yeah. And he was a bit of a show-off, which is why he was featured in the Mike Walsh Show. You saw so much of him. And we stood side by side, belting... trying to outdo each other. And I think that's what they wanted to see.
Yeah.
They wanted to see someone who would really push through. So to my amazement, absolute amazement, I got the Dodger. And everyone... But I was so disappointed because I really wanted to play Oliver, because I thought Oliver was
too tall.
I was too tall.
You were taller than Mr. Brown, though.
Probably, yes, who was played by Teddy...
Hodgman.
Edward Hodgman. Beg your pardon. Yes.
Adelaide actor.
Wonderful. The cast was incredible.
Was that a time, it took 1966, where they double cast the kids?
Double cast the kids.
Yeah, so you weren't doing 8 shows a week.
No. And sadly, we only did a 3-week season, which was heartbreaking. Well, you see, because it was between, we rehearsed on the Funny Girl set, and I can't remember what was coming in afterwards. It might have been The Odd Couple, some show like that.
With Fred Parslow and... Heinze from Pyjama Game.
But let's not get too stuck on The Odd Couple, because it may not have been The Odd Couple. It might have been Boeing.
I'm just showing off that I knew the cast.
I know. You're talking to an encyclopedia. So anyway, so Williamson's had this gap. And Richard Wordsworth had several years before come out and done Lock Up Your Daughters, which had been a major success.
He directed it as well, didn't he?
Wordsworth. I think, played Fagin. And it was apparently an astonishingly good production. I say apparently because I was in it, I was only 13, so I couldn't really tell. But a lot of people said, in 1960, Johnny Lockwood had played Fagin. He'd done it really, made it really cuddly and friendly.
Whereas, with Sheila Bradley?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Mm. Oh, you are a walking encyclopedia.
No, I've just had a misspent youth.
But Richard Wordsworth was very tall and angular and scary, actually scary to work with. Quite a lofty, remote figure. He was down doing it in Melbourne while we were rehearsing. So we were rehearsed by a man called Danny Davey, the boys. And then at the very last minute, the cast came up, and we had a couple of rehearsals with the grown-ups. I had no idea that the Dodger was such a good part. He would make his entrance about 20 minutes into the show. And when I walked on my first night, the whole audience burst into applause. I couldn't believe it. Of course, they weren't applauding me. Obviously, they were applauding the character. But that would happen night after night after night. It was such a buzz. You know, we used to think it was a bad house if the boxes weren't full. Wow. I mean, it was a total sellout. And it was a three-week season because, as I was saying, Williamson slotted it in. It was Wordsworth's idea. He went to the manager and said, let me do this. God knows exactly why. But because he produced a hit for, I don't know if it was for Williamson or Carol.
Garner Carroll.
Garner Carroll, thank you.
You would have had the Sean Kenny set, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
I hear all about this Sean Kenny set. What was so special about it?
Kenneth Tynan said you walked out whistling the set. what was so special about it? Well, it was perhaps because it was a revolve, and it was... It was a major construction on a revolve that... They brought trucks on from the side and they flew pieces in from the flies to augment it. But it had doorways and nooks and crannies and alleyways, and it gave the impression of back streets of Victorian London. But there were lots of little tricks. There were things that they would, when the bit that was upstage hidden from the audience, they would add little bits and take bits away, and it was very, very cleverly done. And it looked from the front, it just looked like a magic trick, and it moved all the time, and you know, we had to, you know, walk on the revolve and mark time off the revolve and all of that sort of stuff.
So did you meet Tony Lemon before you met Tony Sheldon?
I did, in fact, yes. Right. In fact, Butch, as he was known in those days, was not in, there were two casts as we established, and Tony Sheldon was in the other cast, and we didn't actually meet until he came to Cranbrook. Which would have been in about 1967, I think, probably the following year, when his mother moved to Rose Bay. And we became firm friends, and he taught me so much about musical theatre. I used to go over to his house in the afternoons and look at his amazing collection of LPs of Broadway shows, many of them quite obscure. And I got to know his mother personally, and she taught me the time step in the kitchen, which was fantastic. Because Tony was a dab hand at the time step. I mean, you know, even at the age of 10 or whatever he was. But Nick Enright, there was a... Oh, gosh, what was his name now? I wondered, this will be testing your general knowledge, Peter. A very Levitt, a famous Greek scholar called Levitt or Levis. Was it Levis?
Levis, I think it might be Levis, yes.
I think the name is Levis. And anyway, he was a guy.
Levis, I mean, alone, was his surname.
Well, Nick, of course, was brilliant, and he was at Riverview. And I didn't know that then, of course, but Levis was giving a lecture at Sydney University, and because I was doing Latin at Cranbrook, for some reason we all went along with all the brilliant brains that were doing ancient history and Greek, which I certainly were. I failed Latin, by the way, because I couldn't be bothered learning all those tables. But I'm in this rather big lecture theatre at Sydney University. This was years later. I would have been like 3 years later, 16. It was a bit boring, and there was a break in the middle of the lecture, and this boy in a Riverview uniform came bouncing up to me and said, "Hello, you're Andrew Sharp, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Hi, I'm Nick Enright. I saw you in Oliver. You were terrific." How about that?
Wow.
Astonishing to me. I don't know how. I never you know, the thing is, so many things happen, so many serendipitous things happen to us when we are younger. Did to me anyway. Yeah. And you kind of took it all for granted. You forgot to say, hang on a second, how did you possibly remember me? But the weird thing is that he was besotted with Oliver. And of course, 2 years, maybe about 2 years later, Williamson's, having had this big hit that they couldn't capitalize on because they hadn't left long enough for the season. As I said before, I tried to say it was going around Australia in these three-week slots that Williamson's had in their program. And they did, you know, 3 weeks in Melbourne, 3 weeks in Sydney, 3 weeks in... I mean, it was absurd. And turning people away at every show. So about 18 months later, they brought it back. And I did audition, and Pounder ran those auditions. And I never forget us, me cracking on the top note, because you had to hit an E, I think it was. Right. And she... And she just was very sweet about it. And she said, too bad, Andrew, you, sorry.
And the voice is broken.
The voice is gone. So, but of course, that was when Rod Dunbar played Noah Claypole in the 1966 production, and Nick Enright played it in the subsequent production, which I saw at the Tivoli, and I was disappointed, actually. It had become much more of a pantomime when Richard Wordsworth did it. I mean, they really were playing to the kids.
Yeah.
But when Wordsworth did it, it was, as I said before, it was very dark. And when Nancy got murdered on the steps by Bill Sykes, it was brutal. You didn't see it, but you heard it. And it was, it was disturbing for sure.
Tell me about those formative years at Cranbrook, because one of your classmates is Tony Sheldon, but also one of your teachers is Terry Clark, who you all worked together a couple of times in school drama.
That's right. Terry, of course, had been an actor in rep in England, where he had discovered the works of Harold Pinter, because we're going back now to the late 1960s. And so Pinter was still fairly new. And in fact, I think Terry did the first production of a Pinter play in Sydney was The Birthday Party, directed by Pamela Trethown for Suds. That was a legendary production, and Arthur Dignam was in that.
Because at the time, there's no theatre companies necessarily other than the Old Toad.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I don't even think the Toad had started then.
Right.
No. And Pam's husband was Bill Trethown, who, again, really bizarrely, because my father was a doctor, the Trethowns were friends of our family. And again, it would have been about 1960, and I heard that Pam, who was a lovely woman and a frequent guest at our house, was doing The Birthday Party. And as a starstruck child, I said, oh, I want to be in The Birthday Party. I just assumed, and they all looked down their noses at me. It's a bit, you know, beyond your ken, Andrew. So getting back to Terry. Terry did a production for Suds of The Caretaker with Peter Collingwood and the other Peter Collingwood. There were two actors called Peter Collingwood and Arthur Dignam, and I don't remember who the third man was. And he really believed in doing plays with school kids that would also educate them, that would stretch them a little bit, you know. I mean, nowadays they do a lot of populist works that they might have already seen in the theatre, like musicals. I mean, it's just a different way of approaching
production
it.
Production of Mamma Mia?
Yeah, exactly, something like that, which isn't quite as intellectually as demanding as Pinter would have been. Well, it was in my final year at school, and I played Goldberg and Tony played Meg. And he was sensational and completely instinctive. I mean, from the very first reading, which was like an audition, we just did a cold read around the classroom. And it was just like, where did this character spring from? I mean, it was like this funny little old woman, and when he said, oh, I was the belle of the ball, I know I was the belle of the ball.
It's still so vivid for you.
Very vivid. Yeah. And I used to have to say, you look like a tulip. And Terry really had a very strong feel for the piece. And I remember Sheldon would constantly burst into time steps in rehearsal. If he made a mistake, he had this very annoying, for Terry it was very annoying, he would do this spontaneous little time step in the middle of the rehearsal, and Terry used to say, stop doing that! and it was a real labour of love, and it was also quite groundbreaking, really, for its time. And he taught me, you know, how... one of the things that Terry taught me is that it doesn't really matter what the meaning of this is, as long as you, the actor, have a meaning, an intention in your head. The audience can put any meaning on. We're talking about Pinter here, which is deliberately ambiguous. But he said, you can't play that ambiguity. Leave that up to the audience. You have to be absolutely certain about what you're doing. And that was a very important lesson for a schoolboy to learn.
Yeah. and earning the pause.
Earning the pause.
Earning the pause, or, and acknowledging the pause, which have written it so part, so much part of Pinter.
Yes. I went to, years, decades later, I was talking to a man who's there again, I can't remember it. It was in the London Theatre. He was a very famous sound designer. We're talking about the 1980s now. And I could probably Google it and figure it out. And he did a new play by Pinter. And Pinter told him to bring a stopwatch to the first rehearsal.
Wow.
And they timed the pauses because there was a difference between three dots and a pause and a full stop. And the very different ways that Pinter and that's the beauty of Pinter. It is music, it is music, and it's as much musical as it is anything else. Really, takes you into a different world when it's done right. We also did the Yeoman of the Guard at Cranbrook, which we did as a co-production with Kambala, and I got to meet Vanessa Downing. She was in that, and I played Jack Point. Tony Sheldon wasn't in that. I don't know why. That was the previous year, but there were other directors, there were other teachers. I mean, Cranbrook did about three plays a year. They did a major production and they did one or two smaller ones as well. But I learned so much from Terry, so much. And also he talked a lot about convention, theatrical convention, and you established a convention, you know, like the fourth wall and stuff like that. And you know, once you'd established it, you didn't break it. To me is obvious now, but golly, it's a basic.
Yeah, as a kid, yeah.
But it's a basic rule that you see so often being broken nowadays.
Yeah. You worked again with Terry at the Hunter Valley Theatre Company.
Yes.
That's early in your career?
Yeah, early. Well, I don't know. I didn't have a very long career. Sort of somewhere in the middle.
But, you know, you had all that university theatre. There comes a time where you need to break into the profession and become a professional actor, I guess.
Oh, look, I didn't waste much time doing that because I, at the university, as I said before, I was just constantly in university plays and I wasn't a very good student. I really couldn't wait to join the profession, and I basically threw my second year exams. The Russian was great, by the way, and years later I went to St. Petersburg and got so turned on by the wonderful theatre that I saw there, and my smattering of Russian that I still had helped me through. That was in the early 90s that I went to Russia. My first job was with the Pageant Theatre Company, Theatre and Education. And it was a beautiful tour down on the South Coast. It was a magical event. There were three of us, and we had a combi van, and we went to all these tiny little schools, and we did improvised or semi-improvised plays about pollution, which is what we called an environmental degradation in those days, pollution. They were directed by Chad Hayward, who was quite famous for being in Number 96.
Yeah, doubly.
Yeah, that's right. God, you're encyclopedic. and then from that, I got to work with Tony again, because from that I was in an ill-fated production of The Legend of King O'Malley, which was the first revival, and that was at the old Richbrook Theatre with some wonderful people in the cast.
And Michael Boddy directed it.
And Michael Boddy directed it, and Keith Little choreographed it. But Michael Boddy, lovely man, but he wasn't really a director.
He was one of the authors too, wasn't he?
He was, yes, with Bob Ellis.
Yeah.
And Sheldon was in that too. And I remember Tony did a wonderful impersonation of a seagull. Well, there you go. He did. He was very. There's nothing he couldn't do. But it only lasted like 2 weeks. Right. But it was very fortunate, really, because that's when I think we auditioned for A Hard God, for Nimrod Street, as it was known in those days, which of course. Oh my God, you know, like all these wonderful things that happened that you, as I said already, you sort of took them for granted in a way.
Well, because A Hard God has become a classic of the Australian canon.
Theatre
canon. To be on the ground floor there is quite something.
Yeah.
So how did you learn about auditions? Or
I had an agent.
You had an agent at this time who was putting you up the stuff. Yeah.
And I'm going to try and remember her name, but I can't remember her name.
Gloria Payton.
No, it wasn't Gloria. It was after I did A Hard God that I got with ICS, and that was a wonderful experience. I used to call her Gloria Pay 10%. And Philomena Moore.
I want more.
Yeah. No, they were wonderful, and Gloria was mother to many of us, and a very special person, as indeed was Philomena and Pauline, who joined the crowd later. And there was Anne Churchill Brown there at the agency, and they were wonderful days because you used to show up every Thursday to get your paycheck, because what ICS did was brilliant, was that they used to take 50% of the young actors. Well, they would obviously take their own 10%, and then what was left over, which was in those days somewhat more than people are earning nowadays, sadly, and they would take 50%, and then, with your permission, they put it in a building society.
Oh.
And a lot of their young... A
bit like Super.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot of their young actors bought houses out of the money that Gloria wisely set aside for them, because they were very knowing about actors, especially young actors, and said, you can't manage money. And they were quite right about that. So anyway, you'd go in and you'd get your check on a Thursday, and you'd sit there in the waiting room, and you'd meet all these wonderful actors that you idolised, and older actors, and become on first name terms with them, and it was very special. And there was a wonderful cross pollination of the generations that took place at that time. And sometimes you'd get your check and you'd walk to the bank in Martin Place with them. It was a different world, wasn't it? And I know every older generation probably thinks it was a better world, but I have yet to see a better world. I really do. If you were working, you would see them in person on the Thursday when you collected your cheque. And if they were too busy, you'd just speak to the accountant in the front office and get the cheque. And but if they'd say, you know, we're nothing for you today, oh yeah, Gloria wants to see you, you know, that would be a great opportunity. They were pretty busy those days. Nora Burnett was the name of my first agent, Telecast. And in fact, I had been in the pilot of something called Class of 74, which was one of the early Grundy's shows that, maybe it was even the first Grundy's drama show, that a lot of really fantastic people...
Set in high school, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I was only in the pilot because it was actually after that I got A Hard God. But all of that was through Nora Burnett. A lot of very good people. We were with her at Telecast at North Sydney. And sadly, a lot of people used her as a stepping stone. I remember John Bell telling me how important it... Because I was... let me think. I would have been 18, 19, 20. 20. 19 going on 20, actually, I think. And... when we opened A Hard God, John said, look, you know, you've really got to be with a better agent, because he said, John told me that he had been in Harry Miller's office when Harry Miller was talking to a lesser agent, and he would have a speakerphone and he would shout across the room, you get me that actor for tuppence. And then when he spoke to someone like Gloria Payton or June Cann, he'd get really close to the mic on the phone and he'd purr down the phone and say, oh, hi, Gloria, don't you reckon that we could maybe do a better deal on this? And he said, that's what John told me. They said, that's the difference. So I got with ICS, and that was a wonderful, wonderful thing. But no, Tony and I weren't expecting to get those roles. And of course, nobody really knew that it was going to be the massive hit that it was. I think partly because it was one of the first Australian plays to deal openly with homosexuality.
Yeah.
It was autobiographical on Peter Kanar's part. He, as many people would know, it's the story of a family. It's a family saga, and Gloria Dawn played the matriarch. And there was an Irish Catholic family who'd suffered a lot during the drought. And they had, Gloria in the show had a son called Joe, who meets another boy at the Catholic youth group. And I played the other boy, his name was Jack. And they develop a friendship that becomes sexual. But Jack is, I mean, they're just young, they're 16-year-old boys in 1946. So it's typically exploratory. But unfortunately, the Joe character falls deeply in love with the Jack character. And when Jack realizes that it's getting out of hand, he dumps him. And Tony Sheldon had this heart-rending line. He said, "Don't dump me, Jack. Don't dump me." And of course, you know, God, people were crying. But also people were crying because of Gloria's performance. But there were these two plays running simultaneously. And in the old Stables Theatre, Larry Eastwood designed the set, and our scenes were up near the ceiling, and it wasn't on a platform. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There was this tiny little corner of the stage covered by a canvas flat that we used to have to sort of cower in all night long, whispering, and we would climb up a ladder to appear on this platform that was just below the ceiling. And it wasn't really until they built the set that they realized, oops, there was a beam running right across our acting space, one of the beams holding up the roof. And so suddenly at the last minute, we had to incorporate this beam. We would swing under it and climb over it. And it was quite a good lesson that you know, you introduce an unexpected element at the last minute, which brightens everybody up and makes everybody rethink everything. But it was, I didn't have anything to do with the adults, and nor did Tony's character, Joe, until the very last scene. And suddenly in the last scene, Joe, after being dumped by Jack, Joe suddenly appears on the lower level in the adults' acting space and has a scene with his mother, which was very heart-rending. And Tony was just extraordinary to act with, but so was Gloria. I didn't work directly with Gloria. I had no scenes with her. But that woman, Tony Sheldon told me a story about when Tommy Trinder came out to play Buttons in Tivoli pantomime of Cinderella. And Gloria, who looked a little bit like Barbara Cook, I always think, got to play Cinderella. And this was probably in the 50s, I suppose. And she sort of showed up with her hair in rollers at the first rehearsal and carpet slippers. And Trinder went to the management and said, "I can't possibly work with this woman." And they said, "Relax, just wait, she'll be fine." And of course, she was such a down-to-earth person, so not the star. Similar in a way to Sutherland, actually. Mm. And I remember one night when we were on tour in Brisbane, Tony and I shared a dressing room, and just before the curtain went up, Gloria came into our dressing room to say, "Oh, hi, boys," and she sat in front of our mirror, or she didn't even sat, she stood in front of the mirror. She had a eyebrow pencil, and she quickly put three lines on her forehead and three lines between her eyes, and she went, "Right, that's makeup. Now, motivation." She closed her eyes for 3 seconds, went, "Right, on." So she was very practical, very down to earth. And we would be hiding in this little corner off stage, and she'd be whispering to us, because at the Stables, you know, there was only a canvas flat between you and the audience about 10 feet away. And she'd be one night she was telling us this joke, and her cue came. It was during the show, and she was whispering. And her cue came, she said, "Oh, hang on a sec." She went on, she played this scene that had the audience, you know, like sobbing in the aisles. And then she waddled back and she finished the joke. She finished the punchline. And I was just amazed by her practicality. And what I learned from Gloria was that she took on stage the truth of who she was in that moment. She had no belief in Stanislavski or anything like that. You know, sort of technique, forget it. Just be who you are. And take that on with you. Mm. And I learned that. I saw the same thing later with Alan Bates, who I worked opposite in London many years later, and he was exactly the same. Alan was, but I don't know. You know, like I hesitate because I worked. Sometimes you work with actors nowadays, and they just think all you have to do is be real. Nah, it's your choice of what's real that makes the difference. Yeah. And Stella Adler, who I was fortunate enough to do acting classes with in Los Angeles at a summer school in the early 80s, used to say, God, I learned a lot from that woman, even though she was a monster, frankly, in my opinion, a complete monster. But one of the things she would frequently say is, your talent is in your choice. That was how she defined talent, as choice. And I think that's very wise.
Did you have much contact with Peter Kanaan?
Yeah, but I don't... Well, Peter wasn't allowed to come to rehearsals.
Oh, okay.
Not because he was a monster, but because that was a choice of John's, yeah. John Bell. Yeah. Tony reminded me the other day that... Because we weren't connected to the adults, Tony and I were rehearsed separately. And... towards the end of the rehearsal period, John started doing lots of exercises with us. We would play it as a Senorita and a Toreador, or as we played it like grand opera, or we would pile up chairs and climb up on them and play I'm the King of the Castle and things like this. And we couldn't quite understand what he was getting at. And so partly into the run, we said to him, John, why do we do all those games? He said, well, because you had the part down so quickly that I had to find a way to fill in the rehearsal. But John Bell didn't understand that Tony and I had this friendship that went back. He didn't know that. It was purely coincidence, though, that we did it. And neither of us thought that we were going to, because some, you know, we good contemporaries were going for those roles, and we saw them in the, you know, waiting outside in the waiting room, and we thought, well, he's going to get it. But there was a thing I also reminded Tony of the other day, that there was a moment where Jack has to slap Joe quite hard on the face, and Tony used to stand there unblinking in the moments before I slapped him. It would have hurt. And he told me that he used to make that work for him because he knew that the slap was coming. So to stop himself from flinching, he used to quietly in his head go through the lyrics of Not Getting Married from Company as fast as But that's a lovely story, isn't it? Because, of course, it was 1974, 73, and Sheldon already knew every word of Company. I mean, you know, like this guy is knows everything there is to know about musicals. And we had a lot of fun doing that.
You talk about luminaries like Tony Lamont and Gloria Dawn. You also work with Colleen Clifford.
Yes. Well, that was
talk actually... about Colleen.
Well, that was just after I left school. And that was another weird thing, this connection with Terry Clark. Totally weird. Because in those days, they used to have an auditions column in the Sydney Morning Herald on a Saturday. I mean, what wonderful days they were. And I saw that something called South Coast Summer Theatre was doing a season down in Nowra in January and February of 1971. So I immediately jumped on the phone and got that audition, and it turned out to have been like a version of Summer Stock, and it was organised by Colleen Clifford, and she was also she was assisted by a man called Freddie Prusak. I don't know whatever happened to Freddie Prusak, but he was an American, and he and Colleen put together this this company, and we did Anything Goes. And I got to play Billy Crocker in that. And opposite the wonderful Rona Coleman, who'd just come off My Fair Lady.
Wow.
And she was so good. And I remember when I was 17 and thin as a beanpole. And I remember Colleen, when Rona came to her first rehearsal, they were terrified that they'd put her opposite there, because she was big star then. And I don't know why she hasn't... Another example of, you know, Australia's... wasted talent, really. Beautiful woman and a beautiful actress and a beautiful voice. Everything about her was perfection. And I remember on opening night, she wore perfume. Oh, I was 17. And I never worked with an actress that wore perfume before. It just took my breath away, literally. But anyway, when she came to her first, she didn't come to the early rehearsal. She came into the show about week two. And when she came in, they said, quick, wear this polo neck woolen sweater. It was the middle of summer, but they made me wear a polo neck thick woolen jumper to try to make me look a little bit bulkier because I was such a skinny reed. David Mitchell was in that, and a lot of wonderful people. And I didn't mention the fact that that comic, what's his name, the English Earl Lord Fancourt, you know, that's the guy in Charlie's Aunt, isn't it? But anyway, there's a comic role that was played by Terry Clark. And so when I went to audition for it,
Evelyn Oakley.
Evelyn Oakley. God, you're amazing. Evelyn Oakley, exactly. So I should just shut up and let you tell the story of my life. I'm sure you know. So and I had no idea when I went to apply for that Terry was already involved. Because what I didn't mention was that 1970 was the year that he gave up teaching at Cranbrook, right, and went into the profession full time and had his own luminous career. We did three other shows. We did The Wizard of Oz, which I wasn't in. We did The Miracle Worker, and we did Loot, once again, Terry's choice. So I got to play in Joe Orton's Loot, directed by Terry, down there at Nowra, which shocked the good burghers of Nowra somewhat. But Colleen was really quite a legend.
You joined the company of the Rocky Horror Show as Brad Majors.
Yeah.
Now, that, John Paramore had started.
Yeah. Well, another amazing coincidence, because Little Nell is an old friend of mine. We'd known each other since we were kids. And so, I mean, I was following her career in London while I was in Sydney breathlessly. And I was one of the first people to actually hear somehow the original cast album, and it didn't make much sense to me until I heard Once in a While She Don't Want to Call You, and I thought, oh my god, I love that song. And I just thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice to play Brad? And never in a thousand years ever thought that I'd get the chance. And of course, it opened in Sydney, Jim's incredible production with, you know, Kate and John Paramore and Jane Harders and Reg and everybody. I could just rattle off all their names. They were wonderful people. Terry Bader and Sal Sharrar and Arthur Dignam. It was
Maureen Elkner.
Yes, Maureen was wonderful. It was just the most exciting night in the theatre to be in that packed house, never ever dreaming that I would ever be in it, but again thinking, oh my god, I just love that song. John and Jane were perfection in those roles. And in fact, Jim Sharma went on record as saying, you know, that it was his favourite cast. Mind you, I think he'd only had two casts at that point. It kept running in Sydney, and the original cast, most of them dropped out because their contract came to an end after a year. And they had auditions, and I went up for it and got cast as Brad. And, you know, like, pinch me. Am I awake? Is this really happening? And Paula Maxwell played Janet, and we got on terribly well, and I just loved doing it. But Trevor Kent played Frank, and Trevor, who unfortunately is no longer with us, lovely man, but we were all totally intimidated because Reg Livermore had made this sensational success. And I remember on his last night, he put all his ad-libs in, and the show ran 20 minutes overtime because of all Reg's ad-libs and the roars of laughter that he would get from the audience. And it was a very hard act to follow. We were very plain in comparison. We weren't directed by Jim Sharman. We were directed by Arthur. And Michael Rolfe took over the role of the narrator. And Arthur, who we all loved madly, didn't really, he was very airy and remote. And you'd say, Arthur, on this line here, you know, what do I mean, you know, or am I implying, you know, the usual kind of questions you might, you know, what's the subtext here? Or am I doing that too far? Anyway, whatever the question was, Arthur would look very lofty and look off into the middle distance and stroke his chin. And after a very, very long pause, he'd say, I don't know. So, but anyway, we muddled through. And Trevor found it very, very difficult indeed. And became quite anxious, and after a while he became quite sick, and I was understudying the role of Frank, and I got to go on a few times as Frankenfurter, which was like unbelievable, but I was very silly. Oh my God, I was so stupid. I mean, I thought, oh, this will, I didn't understand a lot of the jokes. I mean, well, I mean, I still don't get it. The opening line, Reg used to get this huge laugh, which would bring down the house on his opening line after Sweet Transvestite. He would say, unlock a mind, unmind a lock. It's the same as the beginning of the end. Do you follow? Bring the house down. And I'm going, I don't get it. Like, I don't think it's very funny. So I was petrified going on. But I was very secure in the music. I must say, I did enjoy the singing very much, and the songs were so much fun to sing. But it was a funny thing. You know, coming down the catwalk, oh, well, actually, I should, before I talk about that, I might mention that after 10 months or something, my contract was up, and it was moving to Melbourne in a couple of months anyway. And Greg Apps took over as Brad, and Greg, who's now in casting, Greg took it down to Melbourne as Brad. And I went off, and a few funny things happened. I don't know, this is a very long story, but I wasn't working at the time, and my sister had a five-year-old son, my nephew, and they were up at some farm in Braidwood, and she asked me if I would be a clown at his birthday party. And so I was in full clown makeup at this five-year-old's birthday party, being climbed all over by the children, who were just trying to pull my nose off and kick me in the guts. Some mother came rushing out of the house, and she said, oh, Andrew, you wanted on the telephone. I thought, thank God I can escape from this these dreadful children. And I went to the phone, and it was Mike Mullins on the phone. And he was doing a production at the Stables Theatre of The Unseen Hand by Sam Shepard. And a man called Rats Bander was playing the boy in that production. And Nick Lathouris had the main role. And Andrew Simon was in it. And there was a good cast. And they said, Rats Bander has just dropped out, and we'd like you to come and take over this part. And I said, great. And when do I start? They said, well, actually, tomorrow morning. So I immediately didn't go back to the children. They could find their own games to play. I took all the makeup off and raced down to Sydney in the next train, and showed up for rehearsal the next day. It turns out it was the biggest role. He had pages and pages of Che Guevara to recite, this character, the boy, in The Unseen Hand. And we had like 5 days before opening. So I did it anyhow, managed to get the lines down and opened the piece, and sort of lost my voice in the meantime because I didn't get much sleep. And Richard Harper, who was the company manager of Rocky Horror, I'm at this at the Stables Theatre, and I'm on stage taking the bows, and I look off to my right, and there standing in the dressing room was Richard Harper. And I'm thinking, what the hell? And I come off stage. Richard said, Trevor Kent's sick. The audience is waiting. This is the second show on a Friday night, which used to start about 9 o'clock. And he said, you've got to go on. The show's got to go on. We've got a full house of people. Trevor's off. And so I went. It was also, by the way, I should mention the fact that it was the last night of The Unseen Hand. So dovetailed perfectly.
Yeah.
So I came. So we got into a hire car. We whizzed across from Darlinghurst to Glebe, me taking my makeup off in the back of this car, and I arrived at the theatre. The audience was already at this time in the foyer, because it was half an hour before the curtain was supposed, after the curtain was supposed to have gone up. The audience was about to be getting their money back. Richard Harper and I rushed through the crowded foyer, and Richard said, "Ladies and gentlemen, attention please, the understudy has arrived, the show will go on." And like all like a toreador in Carmen, all these people parted like the Red Sea as I ran up the stairs to the dressing rooms, which were at the back of the circle, and everyone clapped as I ran past. But I had very little voice, Peter, and so I had to kind of, you know, sing over the voice. Anyway, after that I went on for the next 6 weeks and finished it in Sydney at the same time they were rehearsing Max Phipps to take it over in Melbourne. I'm afraid my stories are terribly long.
Oh no, I love them.
I've got millions of them.
I know, and we're not even halfway there. The season of Sarsaparilla.
Yeah. I don't know where in the chronology that comes.
Well, that's in 1976.
Yeah, that's right. That would have been...
Which is a couple of years after Rocky. But also another classic in the Australian canon.
Yes, well, that was also directed by Jim Sharman with Kate Fitzpatrick, Max Cullen, Paul Bertram, Julianne Newbold, John Jarrett. Oh, wonderful, John. And little old me playing Roy Child, and people kept on saying to me, "Oh, you know, it's such a difficult part." And I had no idea what they were talking about. I was just trying to do it. But I met Harold Hopkins. I'd done a job with Harold at the film school, and he drove me home afterwards. And Harold, as people who knew him would remember, wonderful actor again. He passed away, but he was a fruitarian and he only ate raw fruit and vegetables, and he told me on the way back from this job we'd done together at the film school that, you know, if I became a fruitarian I'd be a much better actor than I was now. And I was very, very impressionable, so I
top
did my
banana.
Well, I'd struggled then to become a fruitarian. And when we were rehearsing Sarsaparilla, I didn't tell Jim or anybody else in the cast, but I was doing a juice fast during that rehearsal period and having colonic irrigations at the same time. And so I was pretty spaced out during those rehearsals. Nobody actually noticed. But what I discovered was that I didn't have the energy not to tell the truth. And that was a good thing, actually, for me personally.
Yeah.
I couldn't maintain it was a couple of weeks during the rehearsal period that I was virtually fasting. And I just didn't have any energy for any bullshit. And I suppose, you know, having turned down NIDA as I did, I mean, I always felt the lack of having had any training. I always felt slightly behind the eight ball there. I didn't really have any technique or even understanding what technique was. I didn't have any system, and I didn't finish telling you, by the way, about Rocky. I have to explain something. Going back to the Rocky story, Arthur had long since left the production, and there's a stage manager whose name was Lloyd Casey, who also is sadly no longer with us. He directed me as Frank. I got no direction at all, except from Lloyd, who wasn't a director, a lovely guy, but no stage manager. And I was totally, I didn't know how to make it work. I didn't know how to get laughs, which Reg was getting, these amazing laughs through all his ad-libs. So I used to lie awake at night trying to think of clever ad-libs, which was a very stupid thing to do. God, I learned everything the hard way, I tell you what. I mean, I'm too embarrassed to even tell you something. All right, okay, I'll tell you one. It was such a bad joke. I'd say, "Oh, Rocky, you're sweet. You're sweet or mine?" Well, I'm glad you're laughing, but the audience would sit there in stony silence. Or I got...
It's not the material, it's the way you say it.
Well, that's what I was saying. That's how Reg got laughs. But anyway, Jim was in London, and Jim finally came and saw the production. He probably was flying out to work with Max to get Max ready for Melbourne. And Jim came and saw my performance, and he came backstage afterwards and he said, his first note to me was, he said, "Will you set Gay Lib back 20 years tonight?" Which was a little bit upsetting.
Yeah.
And then the next thing he said, he taught me how to do my makeup. He gave me a really good makeup to use, as Frank. And he came up to me just before I made my entrance for Sweet Transvestite, which you make from the back of the theatre. One of the great entrances in theatre history, I would suggest. And he whispered in my ear just before I went on, he said, "Play it like a rock star." Well, Peter, it was the best piece of direction you could possibly imagine. As I walked down, how do you do? I walked down that catwalk, and every bit of negativity or self-doubt or fear which came in, or they're going to hate me, or I'm not Reg Livermore, every part of that which came to me, I saw it, and I just said, "Fuck off." I just went, pow, like a sword. I just cut through all that shit, and I just grabbed it. I grabbed the moment and I said, "I am Mick Jagger," to myself, or "I am David Bowie," or "I don't give a fuck." Yeah. Well, the audience just erupted.
Wow.
You know, it was like a completely different experience. And I think, you know, one of the things Stella used to say was, life wears you down. And life has worn me down. And I don't regret that, because it ultimately, you learn, every actor says this as they get older, you just learn to trust yourself. You just learn to say, well, actually, the most valuable commodity I have is my own uniqueness. Like it or lump it, guys. And that's really the secret. But as a young actor, I was always striving to please. Always wanted to be better. I mean, like working with Robin Nevin in Sarsaparilla. I mean, I had scenes right opposite Robin, and I'd be standing on stage thinking to myself, I'm a complete phony. Look at, I mean, what a stupid thing to be thinking while you're actually in the scene.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, she's giving this superb performance 5 feet from my face, and I'm just like in the audience going, my God, you're amazing. You've completely transformed into this character, Podgson. And you just, this is bullshit. Because everybody has that insecurity. And everybody has to learn to cut right through it and just ignore those negative voices in the head. But I've digressed again. Where were we?
We're on Sarsaparilla, then we're back to Rocky Horror. And yeah. Now we're back at Sarsaparilla, which is completely fine. This is a sit-down conversation.
Yeah.
Well,
another thing
about
happened,
life and, well,
another
and the
thing, life and the theatre. Another thing I learned about life and the theatre was in, so because I was on this self-perfection thing, that's why I did the fasting. I didn't fast when I was doing the show. I couldn't possibly have pumped it out across the footlights if I was fasting. And I didn't, and nobody noticed in the rehearsal room. So it can't have been that bad. I got a very bad review from Kippax, I think, after the opening of Sarsaparilla. But Patrick White wrote me a note that I treasure, along with a couple of other autographs I've got in my trunk. And he wrote me a very complimentary letter about my performance, but it worried me because everyone kept saying, it's such a hard role. And I'm thinking, I don't get why it's so hard. Anyway, I was going to yoga classes in Sydney. And I would go to yoga before. These were in the days when yoga wasn't as trendy as it is now. And there was a very good teacher down in Day Street. A lot of people might remember an Indian guy called Acharya Upendra Roy, whose classes I used to go to at like 5 o'clock. And I remember at the end of the class, he said, we're going to do some meditation. I thought, oh, I really ought to go and, you know, get to the theatre on time. And I thought, oh, but meditation, you know, God, perfection, you know, this is so important. So I was late for half hour call because I decided to stay longer at the yoga class. And that wasn't a very good idea and not a very good story, actually. But then there was another night, you'd think I'd have learned. I was backstage in the drama theatre of the Opera House. I was doing yoga behind the scenes. And part of my costume, I had buckle-up sandals as Roy Child. And I'd taken my sandals off to do these asanas in the wings. And I couldn't get them on in time to be on time for my cue, which is another very damning story, isn't it? But I think at the end of the day, as an actor, you know, the work is your spiritual practice, actually. Right. And being in long runs is a kind of meditation, which is something that I learned when I was in London and was in that Simon Gray play. And I never missed a show, and I did 8 shows a week for a year, for 12 months. And that, for me, was my training. And it was a wonderful cast. There were only 4 of us in the cast, Sheila Ballantyne. And bizarrely, talk about another synchronous thing, Sheila Ballantyne had played Faye in the original production of Joe Orton's Lute.
Wow.
And I got to work with her.
Wow.
I mean, incredible. I, in fact, play her lover in the show. She was much older than me, but that was part of the plot. Alan Bates and Nigel Stock. And we decided as a company, with also the stage management and the costume people, that between shows on Wednesdays and Saturdays when we had matinees, that instead of all going out and trying to find a snack in the West End somewhere, it was at the Vaudeville Theatre, and instead of trying to find food on the West End, we would all eat together as a company. And we all bought food. And it was my role to bring salad every week. And I was living in Soho, and I used to run through the Berwick Street Market, and I'd grab all these salad ingredients. And when I wasn't on stage, I'd be madly chopping up salad in my dressing room. So by the end of the first show on a Saturday or a Wednesday, my dressing room looked like a salad bar. And then between shows, and we would sit around, and they would regale one another with these extraordinary stories about their career, about anecdotes, about funny things that had happened. And by this time, I was like well into my 20s, and I listened to what they had learned at drama school, and I suddenly began to think, I learned all that through doing it.
Yeah.
I learned all that the hard way.
Yeah.
And that's why I decided, really, that the best teacher is a rising curtain. You know, when the audience is out there. I mean, Bob Hope once said, it's easy to be funny when there's 2,000 people expecting you to be funny. Do you know? And I made every mistake in the book. And probably just as well that I went to London. Otherwise, I never would have got cast in anything in Australia. But
you're learning from great directors, too, who are become your teachers.
Yes.
And you got to work with Michael Blakemore.
I didn't actually get to work with Blakemore directly, except
in his production yeah.
of Death Trap. The play that I did the longest was 8 times a week for a year was Stage Struck by Simon Gray. And that was, I learned so much there was from Alan Bates. God, it was a masterclass working opposite that man.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very well-written play, and I can say that because it's never really been revived. I mean, Simon Gray wrote some great plays, but he wrote this one in a fit of anger, and that's another story. It was never really supposed to go on. But Michael Cotterham put it on as a vehicle for Alan Bates and to make a bit of money. And it ran for a whole year, as I mentioned, though Alan and Sheila and Nigel only stayed in it for the first 4 months, and I was offered, I was actually in a run of show contract, and Michael Cotterham said, look, you can go with them if you want to, but it wasn't very well written, and I didn't really think that I'd cracked it, and I didn't want anybody else taking it over. So I thought, and I was living in Soho, which was like a walk from the theatre. I was having a dream life, really. And so I thought, no, yeah, bird in the hand and all of that. But I used to talk about rehearsing in front of the public, still trying to make the thing work several weeks into the run. And I wouldn't make major changes, but I might try a slight shift in emphasis on a line or slightly alter a timing, you know, just little tweaks here and there. You know, you always try, and that's the joy of a long run. You can improve it and polish it. And if something was a little bit off on stage, in character, Alan would look at me like, are you all there? Are you mad? I mean, if something wasn't ringing true, in character, Alan would look at me like, your character, you're a bit weird, you know? And it was like a very intimate conversation with him. He was so natural and so engaged. And like I was saying before about Gloria, he would just bring himself onto the... I mean, look, the curtain was always late rising. We were in the opening scene, and it was a living room set, lovely padded chintzy furniture everywhere. And Alan would go up early to the stage and lie around in one of the couches, and all the stage crew would be there, and he'd be regaling people with wonderful anecdotes, and people would be laughing. We'd be behind the fire curtain. And we'd hear the audience kind of coming in, but, you know, we'd be cracking jokes. The house manager would come around from the box office, and she'd be looking at her watch, and she'd be saying, Alan, we've really got to start. He said, just another story. You know, oh, all right, I suppose we better start. And, you know, so we'd take our places and the show would begin, and it was almost just like the curtain would rise. There was one really significant thing which I found very interesting working on the West End. We rehearsed in a rehearsal room, of course, and everybody talked to each other very truthfully in the way that you and I are talking today. And when we opened, our previews were in Richmond, and on the very first night the curtain rose. Throughout the rehearsal period, we'd just been chatting to one another like this. And the moment the curtain rose, suddenly everybody started talking like this. Exactly the same way of talking, but with this... I hope I didn't blow your microphone there.
No, it's a very good example.
There was no discussion about it.
Yeah.
The curtain rose,
yeah.
And everyone just started projecting.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, whoa, here we go. So I just joined in.
Yeah.
And just started projecting as well. And we never went back to that conversational tone.
Right.
And this is one of the things that I learned in England. You know, they all have such fabulous projection. Yeah. Or they did then in the 1970s. Yeah. I don't know about today. And diction.
Yeah.
And really, the technique of everybody was incredible. And it was like playing tennis against really good professionals.
Yeah.
And the other thing I loved about working in London was, I mean, every time... when I did the season at Sarsaparilla, for example, there was always somebody in the audience that I knew.
Mm.
I mean, I never did a show in Sydney, virtually, practically, without knowing someone in the house.
Mm.
And... night after night after night in London, I'd leave the stage door and just no one was there.
Mm.
And it was very liberating.
Mm.
Mm. I really felt like a professional.
Well, you were.
Well, yes, I was. Yeah. And that year in Stage Struck really taught me my craft. Because I went on in every single imaginable condition. Happy, sad, brokenhearted.
Do you miss it?
Oh, yes, of course I do.
Did you decide to give it up, or did it give you up?
I didn't really tell you about Death Trap, by the way. I was dying to tell you about Death Trap. But of course I missed
it. You can tell me about Death Trap.
Huh?
We'll come back to this. Tell me about Death Trap.
But it was funny, you know. Well, it was funny because I went from a show called Stage Struck to another show called Death Trap, right?
Yeah.
And I was the third... Clifford Anderson. It had been running already for a couple of years in London, and so I was in the beginning of the third year. And William Franklin was playing, I can't remember the name of the writer suddenly, the lead. But William Franklin, or Bill as we called him, he directed it actually, which was a bit unfortunate because Blakemore had directed it on Broadway, and he directed it like clockwork. It's a piece of clockwork, Death Trap. It was beautifully blocked and beautifully timed, but Bill Franklin was a bit turning it into the Bill Franklin show. I can say all this because he's passed away as well.
Yeah.
And that was a little bit disappointing. But Blakemore came and saw my first performance, which was on a Monday night, because I finished in Stage Struck on Saturday and opened in Death Trap on the Monday. How about that?
Mm.
I mean, amazing.
Yeah.
And apparently he said to the house manager after the show, he said, I better go around and pat him on the head. Thanks for telling me that, house manager. But he came and he said to me, he said, he was complimentary. He said, it's very good. He said, but it's not quite in your body yet. And I thought that was a very interesting note. That was the only note I remember him giving me. And that was because we rehearsed it very fast. I mean, that's another thing about the West End, the takeover casts. I mean, you know, how many hours is that? Like 2 weeks rehearsal, Monday to Friday, 10 to 4 with a lunch break. You know, it's not many hours, really. And I took that to heart. And that was another very valuable lesson, that actually you've got to get, every part's got to be in your body. In your gut. And yes, I do miss it terribly. And why did I stop? Partly because, in London, people said to me, why did you leave London? Well, because I always felt like I should have been back home in Australia. It was a childhood dream to work in the West End, especially given the first play I ever saw with My Fair Lady. You know, the opening scenes at St. Paul's Covent Garden, for God's sake. It was like I realized my childhood dream, and I was at a party and I met a very nice man who was probably my age now, in his 70s, and we were just talking at the party, and he said he was playing a butler in Rep somewhere up north, and then it emerged that he was Australian. I don't know who it was. It wasn't somebody famous. And that's, I realized that, my God, you know, like, I have been so lucky, because I did other work in London that I didn't mention as well. And I've been so lucky. I really want to direct. There's a great joke about Mother Teresa, that when she goes to heaven, God's, or St. Peter says, look, you know, I'm sorry, you've got to go back to Earth. You've got to be reincarnated just one more time. But the good news is you can do anything you want. You don't have to be working in the slums of Calcutta. And Mother Teresa says, really? And he says, yes, anything you want. She says, oh, what I really want to do is direct. So I'm thinking, well, you know, just like every other actor, I wanted to direct. But I had done a bit of directing, and I felt much more, much less anxious when I was working as a director, much more on firm ground. But that's when I went to America and studied a bit with Stella Adler at her summer school in Los Angeles. And the story of my life, it's a little bit long to go into here, but life kind of led me away from the theatre. Well, not entirely, not at all. I mean, I continued to work. I mean, I came back to Sydney in the early 80s in that boom time of the film industry, and I did a couple of movies. But again, I was disappointed in myself as an actor. I felt limited, and I felt that I really wanted to direct. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to direct, I probably should learn how to direct film. So I went to Swinburne and I did the postgraduate course at Swinburne, made a film, came out clutching my film and took to all the producers in town. And they all said, well, actually, we want you to write something. And I went, I don't want to be a writer. I want to be a director. So then a very dear friend of mine who was stage manager at the opera said, why don't you come along and watch how we direct opera? And I watched Joran Javafelt direct The Coronation of Poppea by Monteverdi, and absolutely fell in love with it. He was a wonderful director, and it was a magnificent production. So I begged the opera to let me have any job there behind the scenes, and I've got a few anecdotes about that too. And I worked as an assistant director on several productions, and then I thought, well, this will be my path. But I was hitting 40, and I went back to England. But my mother was very ill with dementia, and I was trying to establish myself as an opera director in England and flying back to Australia a lot to be with the family. This was in the 90s. And I did end up actually directing opera students in opera colleges, and I did a couple of productions for a festival in London. Then by this time I was turning 50, my mother was still alive. My former partner and I decided to move to his country town, which is a place called Baraba near Tamworth, and I discovered Australia. I discovered the bush, and I thought, oh my God, all my life I've wanted to live in London or the big, you know, Broadway or something, and these people are wonderful and they don't have any culture. So I got involved in I got so much buzz out of sharing my... I started a play reading group, and then a big building on the main street came on the market, and it had an old pool hall in it, and my mother passed away, and I inherited enough money to buy the building and renovate it and turn the pool hall into a theatre. So I turned the building into the Playhouse Hotel, I called it, and thought, oh, I'll put on plays, and then I'll, don't know what I'll do then. I had no exit strategy, whoops. And of course, suddenly I found myself running a boutique hotel where anybody only ever wanted to eat and drink and sleep. No one wanted to go to the theatre. But there were touring productions and bands, and so I found myself being a presenter rather than a producer. And I worked with critical stages and hit productions, I didn't work with them, but I provided the venue. I created an 80-seat studio theatre in the Playhouse Hotel. And that was a little bit heartbreaking for me, though, because I was presenting other people's work and not actually... getting my rocks on. But unbeknownst to me, I was starring in my own show as hotelier. You know, like, there's a lot of showbiz in hospitality. Mm. And working in a restaurant is very similar to working in a theatre. Really, it's all theatre. And that's something I would constantly tell to the people working for me. But then I kind of got stuck there for the last X number of years. And I do need to sell it, and I am hoping to sell it soon. And
you know. So we might see you on the boards again.
Well, if anyone will have me. I'm virtually, controllable.
Wouldn't say that.
Well, you've been controlling me with your attention.
All through this conversation. How did it go, do you think? It was good. We had a good
chat. We finished?
Yeah.
How long did we go for?
We're there. We're signing off now.
Oh, are we going? Are we still going?
Yeah, we're still going.
Oh, God.
I was just asking you how we went.
I didn't feel a thing.
Good. Well, that's good. Andrew Sharp, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Peter. It's a lovely opportunity to talk about myself.
Andrew's Hotel is the Playhouse Hotel in Baraba. If in the area, it's well worth a visit. The Playhouse Hotel is housed in premises formerly known as the Central Hotel, which was the oldest of Baraba's four pubs. The building was constructed out of handmade brick in 1905 on a crossroads in the middle of town, and for decades was considered the town's top pub. In 1955, at the height of the wool boom, the building was significantly modernised by then-owners Tooth's Brewery. It changed hands several times again, and in 2002 was purchased by Andrew Sharp, who set about doing major repairs and renovations. As part of this project, the hotel's disused pool room was converted into an 80-seat studio-style theatre, and the building reopened in mid-2007 as the Playhouse Hotel. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, you can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by visiting our website, www.stagespodcast.com.au. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.